Welcome to Sitting Around Talking Movies. I'm Neil Rosen. We're back doing regular movies. The last 2 weeks we were at the Hampton Film Festival, so today...
Doing irregular movies.
We're talking about stuff, we're catching up on stuff that opened over the last 2 weeks, like Moonlight, like The Accountant, like In a Valley of Violence with Ethan Hawke, like... what else are we talking about?
Maybe Mr. Church.
Mr. Church with Eddie Murphy. We're going to talk about that. And a whole bunch of stuff that's on demand and DVD. And joining me, as always, Bill Brigoli.
Hi there.
Bill McCuddy.
That's me.
And sitting in with us this week is Justine Browning.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. After show to Talking Pictures, television show that airs on New York One locally and Time Warner nationally. And what do we do on this show, Bill McCuddy?
We watch the bad movies, so you don't have to.
That's absolutely true. So we're going to start talking about Moonlight. Hey, Bill, why don't you tell everybody what Moonlight is about?
It's based on a play, I think, called Black People Look Blue in the Moonlight. It's a romance told in three different stages of a young man's life. And it's gay, it's black, it's small, and it's very beautifully rendered, I think. I'm not sure anyone's going to go see it. But
I
like the
movie. I think a lot of people see it. There's a lot of Oscar buzz around it.
Well, there's Oscar buzz around it, but there's also, I'm not sure that the audience that, look, here's my thing on this movie. We get so few African-American films made that here's one that a lot of African-Americans may not go see. And that's a shame. That's too bad. It's a really, really fine film.
But the highbrow filmgoer audiences are already promoting it night and day on
absolutely.
Twitter and Facebook.
But Tyler Perry's not in it, so
well,
it's going to go.
You know, as you said, Bill, I mean, the three chapters take place when the kid's in grade school, the kid's in high school, and then as an adult. And he's a scrawny kid who, you know, the first, when he's in grade school, he's being picked on.
His nickname is Little.
Yeah, he's being picked on by the kids in this urban area of Miami. And he's befriended by, the mother's is a crack addict. He has no father. His father figure is the neighborhood drug dealer, who is actually, as bad as that sounds, is actually kind of the nicest person to him at that stage of his life.
Has a great wife, girlfriend that sort of takes this kid under her wing.
The second chapter, he's still scrawny. He's in high school, still being bullied. And it's there kind of where he starts to question and explore his sexuality. And in the third chapter, he's an adult and he's buffed up. And he kind of
seeks out a former
lover from when he was in high school. I don't want to say any more to be considered a spoiler. I think that all the three actors that play him at different phases of his life are excellent. And they must have all kind of sat down together before they shot the film because there's little characteristics of each of them that they all share.
Well, I think they look a lot alike, too. You don't agree with me in the third casting, but I think that each next incarnation is a harder version of the last person, and I think there's kind of a genius in that. I mean, there's no special effects in this movie. That's the special effect for me.
Well, I think that... I think it was well done. I mean, frankly, we talked about on the show a couple of weeks ago, we talked about a movie called Kicks, which is about sneaker culture in the urban areas of Oakland, where a scrawny kid can't afford a pair of sneakers. And, you know, his friends don't like him. He can't pick up girls. All of a sudden, he scrapes together $225, buys a pair of Air Jordans. All of a sudden, the girls are like, come to this party, you know?
Well, that's a much more lightweight film.
You like
it more than Moonlight, right?
I do like it more than Moonlight. I think it's a...
Justine, jump in here. Do you want to see it? Tell our audience you want to see it. Tell our audience you're looking forward to seeing it.
That's funny. Listen, Moonlight, this guy, Barry Jenkins, the writer-director of Moonlight, I think you're gonna hear a lot from this guy in the future.
Oh, no, absolutely.
I think that, you know, it's he's going to be remembered come Oscar time, as they say, as the film will.
In your mind this is one of the 10 nominated?
No doubt in my mind. And there's political aspects to why, other than it being a good film, you know, everybody was saying that Birth of a Nation was going to be nominated, and now that's not going to be nominated, or I don't know, it's questionable because of the allegations.
No, this is the white guilt nominee this year. This is the one to go
movie.
To.
I mean,
yes, it is. I don't mean to take anything away from it for that, but you're right. Out of black Oscar, white Oscar, so white, everything last year, there was going to be an anointed African-American film, and it was supposed to be Birth of a Nation.
Might not be it because the writer-director of that is in a controversy about being accused of rape.
Which in and of itself is a shame because it's a good movie also. In fact, let me ask you point blank. Did you like that movie better? Did you like Birth of a Nation better than Moonlight?
They're so hard to compare. It's really apples and oranges. I mean, you know, one is about a historical drama about, you know, a slave uproar, you know, a revolt.
Okay, they're both nominated for Broadcast Film Critics Association Best Film of the Year. Which one do you vote for?
Okay, let's say those are the only – if you create a hypothetical situation for me where the only two movies that are nominated for whatever reason are Birth of a Nation and Moonlight, I would vote for Birth of a Nation.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
What
okay.
would you vote for in that hypothetical situation?
I like Moonlight better.
Okay. All right, let's move on.
We're different, you and I.
All right, there's a movie called The Accountants. Bill Bregoli, why don't you tell us about that movie?
Well, it follows the life of a young savant. This guy can't do anything. He can't look you in the face.
He
can't
do much. Autism, Asperger's.
Yeah, sort of like a relative of mine.
The director, and the screenwriter couldn't do anything either.
That's right. Well, he can add up. He can add numbers. You can tell him 12 times 365,205, and he'll come up with an answer. I cannot. But he also has a secret life. You see, he... his dad figured out this kid's going to be beaten up, and rather than name him Sue, he beats up the kid and teaches him martial arts and that sort of thing.
And his brother.
And his brother as well, right. And you kind of forget about the brother for a while.
Yes, until for a while.
But But anyway, he makes a living doing the books of rather shady companies, and he's asked to do the books of this one particular company. He finds out something strange. And he also meets a young lady played by Anna Kendrick who kind of helps him get through life.
She was the initial whistleblower at the company that said, hey, this doesn't all add up, and they call him in.
Yeah, there's millions of dollars that are missing.
And there's John Lithgow in this movie and J.K. Simmons and a lot of really good people.
John Bernthal is in it. I like him very much.
Yeah.
Here's the thing with this movie, you know? For the first hour, maybe 45 minutes, I'm kind of with the movie. I'm like, this is interesting. I mean, you got like this Rain Man-like type guy who's also like a contract killer. He's like trained to like – he's a human killing machine.
Collects Jackson Pollock paintings in an Airstream trailer.
But man, does this thing go off the rails about an hour in. I mean, nothing makes sense. They put things together. I mean, so what do? We're just the director's like, let's throw a car chase scene in, which is terrible car chase. Let's throw some like, you know, shoot 'em up stuff. And
it also, you're not mentioning, for the last 10 minutes is a book on tape. They're just narrating all these plot points that the actors are just standing there while the voiceover is going, and then this means this, and then that happened to this, and then...
Right. Well, when they throw out the final thing, this is what's really wrong with this company's books, you go, okay, so what?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think...
Crazy Eddie? What?
I think Affleck and Kendrick did an okay job. I mean, they're okay, but I think they were kind of miscast. I think other actors... could have, like, you put a different actor in
other
that role.
Actors would not have changed the horrible ending.
No, but it might have been more entertaining. Affleck was kind of like flat, and Kendrick was kind of like off also. It was just not working.
Can I ask?
Please.
Another movie just
have you seen this one?
I have seen a lot of the reviews. I've watched a lot of the reviews, and it seems that it's such a polarizing movie that some people actually really, really like it.
Yeah.
And I'm
who likes this movie?
No, it has. It did some money. It made some dough.
Well, Bill, did you?
Yes. Well, I have some sound because I'm the vice president of sound here at this company.
President.
And I have Ben Affleck talking about and describing. What's strange about his character?
On the one hand, he's a guy who's kind of mild-mannered, math prodigy. And on the other hand, he's somebody who has got a ton of fight training. And those two things are sort of at odds in him. And really, it's a movie about how he has to reconcile his past with who he is now.
And I also have J.K. Simmons, who I always like in movies. And
awesome in The Drum Thing.
Whiplash.
Yes, The Drum Thing. That was the original title for that movie.
That's right.
Also my number one movie that year.
And he's fun in those commercials.
But dum dum dum.
We are farmers. Bum ba dum bum 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 bum.
That's right. Well, he talked about the movie as well.
It sort of bends genres or combines genres. You know, I mean, it is an action movie. It is a drama. It is a thriller. There's a love story. It's a family drama. It's a comedy. It has, you know, lots of comic moments.
Did he bring that up, the farmers thing?
No, he didn't.
Probably makes more money from the farmers thing than he does from...
He's also the yellow M&M in the M&M commercials. Did you know that?
Is that true?
That is a true.
A guy I worked with, Billy West, who I worked
with
Billy
West. Great voice guy.
Yeah.
Plays millions of games. Isn't he in Ren and Stimpy?
Yeah, he was one of the voices in Ren and Stimpy, right. And we worked together on a show called The Big Mattress in Boston many years ago.
Well, he was a big Howard Stern...
Yeah, they had a falling out, right? They.
Yeah, Charles and...
Yeah.
Well, that must have been rectified because a couple of years ago... on Sternthology, which is where they play on the weekends reruns, they had like a tribute to Billy West like for the afternoon. So they must have made up.
But just out of curiosity, did we play the J.K. Simmons sot?
Play it, yes, babe.
Already?
We did.
Okay, thank
we did.
You. Okay. Yeah. So, I don't, I'm not a huge fan of The Accountant, and I can't believe that I'm hearing discussions now that there may be a sequel to it because it made enough money.
What do you think of it, Pregoli?
It tried a lot of things. I got to give it credit for trying some stuff, especially a sort of superhero character with no personality. That's an interesting thing to try. Yeah, and some of the action, but the action was really badly shot, I thought.
That car chase was like the lamest car chase I've like seen. It's a misfire.
Do you think it would have been benefited from being edited down a bit more? I know it's a little over.
It needed a different ending. It needed a totally different ending. Yeah, I'm with everybody about how interesting an accountant with Asperger's could be.
Autism.
But it doesn't. And then there's a reveal about who's been talking to him on the phone that'll just make your eyes roll right back.
Nothing makes sense.
Your head.
The ending is so bad that no matter what I liked in the beginning,
it's so bad.
That it kind of negates everything that came before that. Hey, you know, before we get to another movie, Bill McCuddy is a stand-up comedian on the side. He used to do it a lot. And Kevin Meaney.
Don't go by this show.
Kevin Meaney.
I opened for him many times. This is a guy, I mean, if you don't know the name, he did a television version, which wasn't very good, but he's good in it, on Uncle Buck.
Well, you used to tell me this story, Bill, which was great. My memory being what it is, I remember things that I want to remember. And you were telling me that when he bombed on stage, and it's funny, Louis C.K. wrote a whole email the other day about Barry Crimmins, who discovered a lot of comics in Boston, and also Kevin Meaney. And I never saw what I'm about to say, but you told me that when he bombed on stage, he used to sing this thing called
"He Loved
It."
I don't care. I don't care. They don't like me, and I don't care. He's horrible. I don't care. He would just go into the, and he could do it for like.
My jokes are bombing.
He could do it for like 5 minutes.
Right?
He could do it for 5 minutes.
We said half an hour.
Yeah, it was incredible. He and I, they added a show one time.
They
we were playing.
Like me, but I don't, that's very.
We
funny.
Were playing Dan Rosen and Bob Somerby's club down in Baltimore that a lot of comics went to. Called the Charm City Comedy Club, and they added an extra show with Kevin, and nobody came because they didn't advertise it correctly or something. It may have been a weather issue. 4 people showed up. I did my regular opening act from the stage. Kevin gets up and goes, "What are you doing? We've got to sit with them." So he sits down, and does his whole act sort of sitting and talking to them and singing to them, and it was just an amazing evening. So
and apparently he did Letterman, and he killed. He did so great that Carson said, "I want him on The Tonight Show, and I want him to do the same exact 5 minutes that he just did on Letterman."
It's possible. I hadn't heard that, but he was very, very funny. He would sing a whole Johnny Mathis Christmas album, which was funny for like the first song, and then audiences were like, "Stop," and then it got so funny again after about 10 more minutes that people just loved it.
So we're actually going to talk about a movie now. That Justine Browning has seen.
Wow, what are the odds?
It's called In a Valley of Violence, and it's in theaters, and it's on demand, and it stars Ethan Hawke.
Well, let Justine tell us about it.
But you did such a better intro.
No.
I want
Justine. Speaking to your microphone.
I want Justine to talk and tell us about it.
Well, just give us the broad strokes.
Well, Well, it's basically a revenge tale, similar to the John Wick story we saw actually a couple of years ago. And it's a Western. It's produced by Jason Blum. It's directed by Ty West. And it actually was written with Ethan Hawke in mind. Jason Blum and Ethan Hawke had collaborated for a few films before, like Sinister, and they were looking for a vehicle like this. So it's a revenge tale about a drifter and his dog. Something terrible happens, and...
He wants revenge.
Well, I loved it.
Let's mention John Travolta is also the marshal of the small town Denton that they're trying to pass through.
And his Taysa Farmiga.
Yeah, Taysa
Farmiga. Born out of her mind.
And looks exactly like her sister Vera. Well, there's two.
I liked it a lot.
The two.
You know, it's sort of a tribute to old Westerns, but with a winking eye. It's funny.
The opening credit sequence looks like an old, spaghetti Western.
Yeah.
It's got its tongue firmly in its cheek. There's some laugh out loud funny moments in it. But I have to tell you, I think Ethan Hawke is amazing in this thing, as he was in Magnificent Seven.
I agree.
He's making a place for himself in Westerns. He obviously likes it.
He told me, I interviewed him, and he told me that this is part of a Western trilogy. He has three Westerns
he's going to come back as Paul.
He did three Westerns. He shot three Westerns last year. And here's an interesting piece of information. The town where In a Valley of Violence was shot is the same town where they shot The Magnificent Seven.
Mm.
So
it is? Because what I read was this town was built for the movie.
Well, maybe they built it for In a Valley of Violence and they left it up there.
Maybe.
But apparently, according to Ethan Hawke, who I'm going to listen to over what you read, is that there's a lot of these Western towns that were, when Westerns were in their heydays, in the 40s when Hollywood was just churning out dozens, and each studio was churning out dozens of Westerns, and then on television when all the studios were making all Gunsmoke and Bonanza and...
The Rifleman and all of that stuff.
The Rifleman. Did you say The Rifleman?
The Rifleman, yeah.
Yeah, with Chuck Connors and
I wanted that gun. That rifle was cool.
Right, and even in the 60s, Wild Wild West. So they built all these Western towns. Each studio back lot had a Western town, but they also had Western towns that were built, like, that they needed more room, that they built out in the middle of nowhere, like an hour or two.
So they'd have a vista behind them. They'd have mountains.
Out in L.A., John Ford.
Well, this particular movie was shot.
So they found this one that was, like, kind of, like, left over from you. It hadn't been used, and they kind of
dressed it up. Well, this is in New Mexico.
Yeah, they dressed it up, and they used it for both of those movies. But I liked it. I like this guy who plays the bad guy in it. The actor's name is James Ransone. And I think the dog's great.
Yes.
The dog, Jumpy the dog, who has his own
for a while.
How they searched high and low to get the right dog after.
The dog's great.
Apparently,
for a while.
Ethan Hawke, Jumpy the dog has his own YouTube channel.
Oh, my God.
He's like a whole following around Jumpy the dog. And Ethan Hawke told me that.
Dog's terrific for a while.
They were doing a scene, and the wind blew, and this was not in the script, and it screwed up the take. Ethan Hawke's hat blew off. Either the wind blew, or there's a wind machine, and the hat blew off. The dog, without any prompting from anything, jumps up in the air, catches the hat before it hits the ground, and brings it back to Ethan Hawke.
My God.
And that's not in the movie.
And he says to me that the dog knows more vocabulary than any animal he's ever met. Like, where you could talk to the dog, and the dog understands.
Well, he should have written The Accountant then, that dog.
Yeah.
Play credit, Jumpy the dog.
If you like Westerns, In a Valley of Violence, a little touch of Tarantino, a little touch of Sergio Leone.
You mentioned earlier it being shot on film, 35mm. I think that gives it something very unique. And
it kind of does, but I also kind of couldn't tell until somebody told me. And I was like, I guess tape has gotten really good.
All right, moving on. So, Eddie Murphy hasn't done a movie in, 4 years, and he's back. And what does he choose to do? He chooses a movie called Mr. Church, which is a dramatic role. And how can we describe this
movie? Bruce Beresford is behind it. He's the guy that did Driving Miss Daisy, and this is basically the same kind of territory. I mean, this is the magic black man who, comes in and saves the white family. And in this case, it's a dying woman and her daughter, and there's a special
place.
Supposed to be
Natasha
there for—
McAlone.
Yeah. In the words of the late Bob Hope.
Right.
But this is a gig that's supposed to last a couple of weeks and ends up lasting years and years. He ends up helping the daughter go to college. A lot of things that wouldn't, I mean, I'm not saying that wouldn't happen in real life, but there are a lot of moments that are challenged here. This movie feels like it's from a completely different time period. But that said, Eddie Murphy's really good, and you know he thought this was going to be like his Oscar after he marched out of the Dreamgirls Oscar year in a huff, that this does have Oscar bait written all over it. And unfortunately, it's just such an ordinary script, and so I'm not recommending the film.
Well, I do like the film. I don't love the film. You know, we talked about this on the television show last week, and you said you can't separate the two. But I was saying, you know, a lot of complaints that have been, like, railed against this film is the fact that, you know, it's the subservient, you know, black person who kind of is relegated, as you were saying, to this. But I'm saying, what if you cast Jim Carrey in the role and you just looked at the movie, or just somebody else in play? Well, Jim Carrey's played dramatic. Look at Eternal
Sunshine. Right, but all the issues we're talking about are race-based. So if you change it to a white guy,
it
wouldn't
really...
Is it race-based?
Because he comes into the family. He's hired by this rich guy who used to be the woman who's dying's lover and says, listen, you know, you're a great cook. Can you take care of her? And the daughter for
all right,
a while.
Race aside, if you put a white guy in this role, it's a completely different movie. I'm sorry. It just is.
I don't know. But, okay, so let's not put race aside.
So Morgan Freeman isn't driving Miss Daisy. So what changes, what happens to that movie?
I thought the actress who played the young girl was very good. The one who played her at a young girl, and then she's older. Yeah, there's some unrealistic parts in this movie.
Britt Robertson, right?
Yeah, and you know.
I always confuse her with that girl from The Book Thief.
Yeah, whatever her name is. Elise, maybe?
Yeah.
No, but you know.
Don't make that mistake at home.
Both of them are a little too good as gold, both characters, the Britt Robertson character and the Eddie Murphy character. And but you know, it's not a great movie, but I think it's an all right. It's all right. It's all right. It's not
did nothing at the box office, so if you're going to discover it all, it's obviously going to be on demand.
Though people want to see it because of Eddie Murphy. I have to tell you, the problem I had with the movie was that the characters, although it takes place in the 1970s and 80s, were acting like they were out of, like, Donna Reed from, like, the 1950s.
Yeah.
I mean, the girl goes on a prom date, and it's like, you know, she leans in for a kiss and says, oh, I just don't, you know, I'm a little shy. I don't, you know if this is appropriate. I mean, like, it's 1970-something. I mean, come on. This is ridiculous. So, not a great movie. It's
talking people out of it for a movie you liked. Just saying.
King Cobra. Talk about King Cobra.
Oh, no, I can't talk about that movie.
It's
so embarrassing. It's so embarrassing.
All right, so here's a movie with James Franco
and Christian Slater. And they make out with each other.
And they're two.
Actually, not with each other.
It's based on a true story about a murder that took place in the gay porn industry.
That murder, by the way, that takes place in the last 30 seconds of the movie.
And, you know, and Christian Slater is a gay porn producer who exploits this young man. And when the young man finds out how much money Christian Slater is making on these movies and that he's been paid like jack
shit. Well, and he
shit,
makes them in the middle of the suburbs. Like he's on a...
Yeah.
Pleasant little cul-de-sac, emphasis on sack. And they're
and
making hardcore movies
and
in his basement.
He wants to leave and go to a rival, wants to go to a rival producer played by James Franco, whose lover is the star of his movies. Something happens. And it's like a Boogie Nights kind of thing. There's a lot of humor in it.
I
enjoyed the film. I enjoyed the film.
It's way gay.
Yes, it's very. So what's
really
the matter
uncomfortable.
With that? So
I'm really
gay.
Uncomfortable
what are you,
with
homophobic?
It. I felt bad for the actors.
So
I was embarrassed
the,
for them.
The concept or the actual incident is until the very end. What do they?
Well, the murder
the
thing
of?
Isn't. Yeah, the
I
murder
think,
is like
yes,
to call it a murder mystery is like
gay love scenes in the movie, and I think the parody of the gay porn films when they have they do these porn films, but you know they're actors acting in it, and the bad acting that you see in these films is
very
funny.
I've seen that before.
You know, I'm just cleaning this pool.
Boogie Nights much better.
Somebody would come by and
Boogie Nights 100 times better.
What's that?
Boogie Nights does that. I mean, a lot of movies have done that. The not funny. I mean, the unintentionally funny porno.
Yeah.
The panel agreed with me last week when we did it on the show.
Not this panel.
You stood alone. Well, this panel again. Justine hasn't seen it, and Bill Regoli hasn't seen it.
Yeah. Run to that.
Yeah, I know.
Only the last 30 seconds.
I know.
Just to see how the
crowd pans out. All right. Last movie. Let's talk about. I'm going to let you choose, Justine. You want to talk about Nerve?
I want want to talk.
You
want
to talk about Captain Fantastic?
I just feel like there's more.
No, I'm going to let you choose
to dig into with Nerve, because it was kind of a very interesting reaction I didn't expect.
All right, tell everybody about Nerve
from the panel.
I didn't realize my friend Neve Schulman did that from Catfish.
Ariel.
Oh, okay.
And Henry Jost. So they, I mean, Neve was obviously a part of Catfish, and he was in the film. So this is the team behind the film that eventually spawned the MTV reality series Catfish. And Emma Roberts is this straight edge.
Whoa. The documentary Catfish made the television show. This is like a game. This is like a video game, right?
No, it's the same team behind that. Sorry.
I'm sorry. Okay, yes.
It's the same team behind Catfish, and so it's a pretty intriguing social commentary on some level about the digital age, about the cruelness of it, about, you know, the anonymous spectators that kind of bask in other people's misery, or, you know, the intrigue of other people's lives. And Emma Roberts is a high school senior who starts to play this online game where you can win get money deposited into your account based on accepting a dare. And gradually, as the film goes on, they get more and more dangerous. And
they're pretty cool. They're like, go kiss a stranger at first. Then it's like, go into the city with that guy. And then it's like, go to Bergdorf Goodman and put on a $7,000 dress. Now leave.
I hated this movie. Does it sound interesting to you?
It has potential.
Yeah,
it has potential, but I think it stinks. First of all, these dares are ridiculous. There's one dare, if you live, you know, we're all here in Manhattan. One of the dares is that Dave Franco has to drive blindfolded on his motorcycle up pretty much the entire length of Park Avenue in the middle of the day.
At a time when
it's
not in the middle of the day.
Well,
it's at night.
A lot of cars on
the street. But there's hardly any on Park Avenue.
Blindfolded at 60 miles an hour on a motorcycle, and he's somehow narrowly avoiding hitting people. And
he just has to get to 60 for a second.
You have to suspend disbelief.
I don't think you can drive 10 miles an hour on a motorcycle blindfolded up Park Avenue.
I do agree with you, but I mean, it does go off the rails.
The ending
gets a little Hunger
but
Games.
But it's completely original until then, I thought.
Filmmakers are trying to impress everybody with their social media terminology.
Yeah, it's a little
that's the world of the story.
And then
Emma
Roberts is like, every dare, it's like truth or dare without the truth. Every dare, she's like, there's no way I'm doing this. Count me out of this one, fellas. I'm not there. And then Dave Franco was like, oh, come on, you got to do this. I'll do it.
Like I said on the show, it's like Law and Order, where they get the guy in the witness room and they did you do it? Did you do it? And then he's like, no. And then my wife always says, you broke me. Like the second later, he goes,
they try
all right.
to set up enough motivation. They do.
The dialogue is
I do think they try to give an extra layer to the characters that isn't the typical stock.
And it looks really cool. The whole city is lit in like blue and yellow light, and it looks like a video game.
All right, one more movie.
What?
Wait, there's more.
But wait, there's more.
Now it's a hostage situation. We're actually taking these people.
Right. Tell them about Captain Fantastic, and then let's wrap it up.
Viggo Mortensen is the dad of a kind of hippie family up in Oregon, living really in the wild, and irresponsibly, to my way of thinking at first. I mean, he's putting these kids through these unbelievable tests. Their mom had left them 3 months earlier because she was ill. Turns out she was terminally ill, takes her own life. He wants to take them back for the funeral, and actually has her last will and testament, which says that she wants to be cremated. They get back there. The dad of the mom, played by Richard Nixon.
We'll try Frank Langella.
Frank Langella, who played Richard Nixon, is really good as the dad. There's a a couple of big scenes. The kids have been homeschooled and they're great. They're written a little too well to my in my opinion. But I think it's like Frank Capra Goes Camping. It's got a happy, cool, upbeat kind of a message, and I like this movie a lot, mostly for Viggo. Viggo's great.
And
the kids are good.
You know, as I said, the young ensemble here, I think, really complements him well. And, you know, as I said earlier, I've never seen Viggo Mortensen in a role like this. I really thought it was actually refreshing to see this kind of role for him. He's an incredibly underrated actor, in my opinion. He gets to do a lot of great things with this role. I do love what it has to say about the environment that the kids are raised in, and how you need to be exposed to social situations. You need to go out into the world. You can't just learn everything, you know, through books or the arts or whatever it is remotely. And I really think, too, this really could have drowned in its own campiness or its own quirkiness. And it ends up being, I think, refreshingly heartwarming in a way that
the only knock is that there's the fish out of water part of it is when they go back to the regular world. It gets really interesting. And that happened. Yeah. That takes a long time to happen.
Viggo Mortensen is terrific here, and so are the kids, and so is Langella. And it has funny moments, like when the oldest son, who, by the way, looks like he came right out of the Culkin family. I thought he was one of the Culkin kids.
I did too, no joke.
And he's out of touch with any sort of social upbringing or contact other than his own family. And he tries to court a girl he meets in a nearby trailer. And, like, they share a kiss. And, like, he's never been with anybody outside of his family. And he's like, okay, we'll have kids and we'll get married. And, you know, and the funny part of that, it's kind of like being there or Christmas in July. It's like the mother was there and they're laughing. They thought he was just goofing on them. You know what I mean?
Okay, so, funny guy. She'll be here tomorrow.
People believe what they want to believe.
Right. They're also in a bank and they see everybody's overweight and they're like, how come everybody? I mean, these kids are in unbelievable shape and they don't understand why
yoga thing he's doing where he's balancing on his feet and his legs. And, you know, that same scene with the courting, you know, then it becomes touching. He's crying to his father and saying, you know, you made me read all these books, but I don't know anything. I don't know. It's almost like that Good Will Hunting thing when Robin Williams goes to Matt Damon and says, yeah, you got a lot of knowledge. You've read stuff about Italy. Mm-hmm. You could probably quote some people that ran. Greece or, in the Middle East. But you've never been anywhere. You've never done anything. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's kind of like that was what the kid... I'm wondering even if the guy who wrote the movie, if that was in his mind when he wrote
Note
that
to listeners, Neil will now talk into the microphone.
Yeah, well, anyway, I think that, it's an interesting look at someone who never walked away from their hippie generation ideals. And you kind of want to say to yourself, you know, is it irresponsible? I mean, in one way, you're taking
it totally is in the beginning
and the TV away from the children. Nope. But is it irresponsible parenting? Because the kids are not acclimated to really live in modern society.
They're also put into some really dangerous situations like mountain climbing. But
yeah. Well, I don't know. What's your favorite Viggo Mortensen movie, Bill Bregoli?
I don't think I have one.
What's A History of Violence? That's great, huh?
Yeah, that was good. Yeah.
Mine is hands down A Walk on the Moon with Diane Lane. That is where he played the Blouse Man, which was the original title of that movie. Right, and then they said, who's going to go to see a movie called The Blouse Man? But it's about the bungalow. They live in and then we'll get out of here. It takes place in 1969. And Diane Lane is staying in a bungalow up in the Catskill Mountains with Tova Felcher, who's her mother-in-law, and Liev Schreiber is the husband. And the way it worked back in those days.
Jewish, I think Diane Lane, too. I don't know.
Yeah. But she was good with that accent, you know. And the way it worked is the wives would stay there all week, and the husbands would go home and work in the city. And people would visit the bungalow colony, like the Blouse Man is here, and the guy would pull up in the truck with like clothing to buy. And
Diane Lane is cavelling.
Viggo Mortensen.
She's Unga Potch.
And
she's all Kaddish.
Anna Paquin is the daughter. Mm-hmm. Anna Paquin is the daughter, and they go to Woodstock. And Anna Paquin sees her mother making out with Viggo Mortensen, who's not her father, who's the Blouse Man.
She gets spelkies
at Woodstock
and starts schwitzing.
Schwitzing, Bill. But nice try, my Irish friend. I'll do the Yiddish pronunciation. This is the Jew on the show. But it is one of my all-time favorite movies, not just my favorite Viggo Mortensen movie. And Viggo got cast in that, he told me, like 3 weeks before, like somebody else was supposed to do it. And he just came in the last minute. The guy dumped out who was supposed to do the role, and he just read the script. And
probably Aidan Quinn or somebody like that. It's one of his earlier stuff.
On the Moon. And if you're going to rent A Walk on the Moon, please don't confuse that movie with A Man on the Moon, which is the Andy Kaufman biopic with Jim Carrey, speaking about Jim Carrey.
It's
not quite as Jewish.
Not quite as much waterfall sex. Andy Kaufman walked into that role right the day before they started shooting. No.
There you go. Anyway, next week, we're going to talk about the movie Loving, which is with Joel Edgerton, and it's based on a true story about a couple that was married, an interracial couple, and they were down south, and they were going to throw them in jail. And
the young woman will be nominated for an Oscar, according to GoldDerby.com. She is currently at 4-1 odds.
And they changed the I'm seeing it tonight, so don't be a spoiler, Bill, but I think they changed some legislation in the United States because of that. It was a landmark case. So anyway, we're going to talk about Loving next week and a whole bunch of other stuff. So thanks for sitting around talking movies with us. For Bill Bregoli.
Goodbye.
Bill McCuddy.
I have my scarf on.
Justine Browning.
I'm looking at Bill McCuddy's socks.
All right. Next time, Justine will see more movies.
Stare at the socks.
We'll sit around talking
movies next
week. Have a good week.